And
good afternoon, Juno, and everybody in Southeast Alaska. It's 2:59 p.m. It's time for another edition of the Juno Afternoon. I'm Ken Fix. I'm going to be your host for today. And on today's show, we're going to continue our Fish 101 series with subsistence biologist Cal Cassipet with the U.S. Forest Service. Debbie Germain from Rain Tree Quilting will share the details about their kids' sewing classes. We'll talk to Pat Race about this weekend's Jump Society Screening Summer Film Fest. And we'll hear a story from former Tongass National Forest District Ranger Pete Griffin. These guests, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, Music, and some more for Tuesday, July 15th, 2014. Stay tuned. National Native News is up first.
This is National Native News. I'm Sarah Gustavus. Children in Indian country have some of the highest rates of diabetes and obesity in the nation. Matt Laszlo reports on how the Obama administration is encouraging kids to be active this summer.
The Let's Move program has been Michelle Obama's principal mission since the president took office in 2008. The Corporation for National and Community Service teamed up with the movement to put the First Lady's healthy guidelines into action. The summer program just kicked off at the National Museum of the American Indian. Public Affairs Officer Leonda Levchik says the series helps children keep their blood pumping during the summer downtime.
When kids are out of school, I think a lot of them may not have the activity, the PE classes that they usually have during school time. So during the summertime, we really want to encourage kids not only to keep up their education and their learning by reading, but also to keep active by moving.
The Department of Education is also weighing in on the fight against childhood obesity. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan, along with other members of the administration, stopped by the museum to encourage kids to get moving. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Visitors to Wyoming's Wind River Indian Reservation will see new historical perspectives on roadside signs and markers. Wyoming Public Radio's Micah Schweitzer reports on the Wind River Interpretive Plan, believed to be the first such collaboration between tribes and state government.
The 129-page interpretive plan offers a tribal perspective on how to tell the history of the Wind River Reservation through historical markers and monuments. Gary Collins is the Northern Arapaho tribal liaison to the state. He says most current roadside signs are written from a Euro-American perspective.
You know, words like massacre and savages and annihilation, just to really negativity towards Indian people during the time they were protecting their land.
Over the past 4 years, the Northern Arapaho and Eastern Shoshone tribes worked with the Wyoming State Historic Preservation Office and the Wyoming Office of Tourism to identify what reservation stories should be told and where. The resulting document offers recommendations for how state agencies and the tribes can work together to tell those stories. The state says the Wind River Interpretive Plan is a starting point for actual projects planned for the coming years. For National Native News, I'm Micah Schweitzer.
The Trading Stories, a Native American Film Festival, was held recently at the Shadron Public Library in Nebraska. Jim Kent was there.
Librarian Annette Peter says the idea for an annual Native American Film Festival has its roots in the relationship Shadron has with its neighboring community of Pine Ridge.
We get a lot of people from Pine Ridge coming to do shopping and stuff. So one of the things first we started was to do a small library, Indigenous People of North America, a lot of Native American books, crafts, history, especially local Native American history. And then from that, we decided to start to do movies.
With a collection that's grown to include everything from classics like Thunderheart to Native American productions like Skins, Annette Peter felt it was time to share films that showed the Hollywood stereotype as well as the reality of the country's first inhabitants.
It's a story about a boy who comes back as a man to the reservation.
Offering an introduction to the film Ishtima, actor Scott Means says he thinks it's important for educational gatherings such as this to take place, especially when audiences are given the opportunity to see films about natives produced by natives.
Because it humanizes us. There's so much of the world who thinks of us as riding the great plains on horseback with our hair flowing in the wind. But that's not us. We're like everybody else.
Scott Means says seeing contemporary films about Native Americans can help non-natives understand the reality of the culture. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
And I'm Sarah Gustavus.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Supported by Sacred Wind Community Connect, providing scholarships and internet training to the Navajo Nation and Pueblo of Laguna in New Mexico. Sacred Wind believes broadband can reinforce Native cultures and offer means for self-determination. SacredWindCommunications.com.
Humboldt State University has a part-time, three-and-a-half-year online Master of Social Work program emphasizing decolonizing work with rural and indigenous communities. Applications accepted from August 1 to begin in January. More at humboldt.edu/socialwork.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
And my first guest in the studio here is Cal Cassipet. He's from the U.S. Forest Service, and he's a subsistence biologist. And this is part of our continuing Fish 101 series. Well, Cal, welcome to the studio. How are you today?
Real good, thanks.
All right, and what does a subsistence biologist do?
Well, my major duties have to do with analyzing proposals from the public for changing regulations for federal subsistence fisheries on federal public lands here in Southeast Alaska. I do some wildlife work as well, and then I'm also a COR on several contracting officers representative on several projects that we have contracts with the state and tribal governments to collect stock assessment information on the forest.
All right, and subsistence fishing is different from sport fishing or commercial fishing. So let the listeners know exactly what defines subsistence fishing.
Well, I like to think of subsistence fishing as a customary and traditional use of fisheries by rural Alaska residents, both native and non-native. That's basically what ANILCA says, Alaska Natural Interest Lands Conservation Act. You know, subsistence fishing, it's fishing for more than just food. I mean, food is a big part of it, but there's more to it than just food. There's cultural issues with it. There's sharing. There's providing for the couixes that happen in the wintertime. Subsistence fishing is more than just food, although food is a big part of it.
Right, and you did mention that before we came on the air, that your responsibilities are kind of limited to freshwater as opposed to the things that are in the saltwater. Is that right?
Correct. The way we asserted jurisdiction after the Katie John rule, after the Katie John case was finally adjudicated, was that we asserted jurisdiction for fisheries on waters basically above the mean high tide line. So that basically means fresh waters.
Yeah. All right. And how do we establish the regulations regarding different fish species and limits for subsistence versus sport fishing and commercial fishing, resident versus non-resident? I know I sprung this question on you before we went on the air, just so you would be prepped for it. Yeah. You said, well, I could talk at least 10 minutes about that one.
Yeah, that's a pretty long and involved answer, but basically, there's, people are calling it dual management for subsistence. That is, the state of Alaska has responsibility for subsistence fisheries in their jurisdiction, and we have responsibility for subsistence fisheries in our jurisdiction. That is freshwater. So it's, like I said, people call it this dual management system. The state continues to promulgate all the regulations for commercial fishing, for sport fishing, sport hunt, general hunting, that sort of thing. And then on the federal side, we also promulgate regulations for fisheries and hunts on federal public lands and waters. That's done by our Federal Subsistence Board. It's made up of the heads of the five federal agencies in Alaska, plus an appointed chair, and that person is appointed by the Secretary of Interior and Agriculture, and then there's an additional two public members on the board who are rural subsistence users, and they also are full board members with full voting. So basically, the way the regulations work on the federal side is that whether it's fish or wildlife, they're alternating schedules. Fish we usually do in the even years, and then wildlife is done in the odd years. But we have a proposal period where anybody can submit a proposal to change regulations for harvest limits or seasons or methods and means or what have you. Those proposals are gathered up, and then we analyze them for the board. We come up with a preliminary staff analysis that's provided to our regional advisory council. Here in Southeast, we have a regional advisory council that serves for Southeast. There's 13 members on that, representing communities across the region. Those regional advisory councils will deliberate every proposal before them and review the staff analysis that we have prepared for them, and then they make a recommendation on whether or not to support the proposal to the Federal Subsistence Board or oppose it, or they may modify that proposal for whatever reason, for conservation or ensuring subsistence priority or what have you. That recommendation then goes to the Federal Subsistence Board, and usually the Federal Subsistence Board meets in January for fisheries and generally in April for wildlife. And they make the final decisions at that time on what particular proposal gets approved or not for implementation. And so that's basically in a nutshell how the federal system works. The state has a similar process in that, but you know their cycles are different. For instance, for fisheries, it's a 3-year cycle. So Southeast is cycling through right now. It's a proposal period for Southeast right now under the Board of Fish side of the table. Under the state system, you have a Board of Fish and a Board of Game. Board of Game takes care of the hunts. That alternates every 2 years for Southeast. Like I said, Board of Fish alternates every 3 years for Southeast. We're in the middle of the cycle right now for Southeast for the Board of Fish. The state system, the Board of Fish, they have their own set of advisory bodies. Those are the local advisory committees, and there's several around Southeast associated with all the communities in Southeast. And so there's a advisory system on the state side as well to advise the state Board of Fish and Board of Game. I'm not a real expert on how the Board of Fish and Board of Game works. I can probably talk more about Federal Subsistence Board authority and information. Anyway, that's kind of how that works. And so, as I kind of got from your question, you know, and I'm sure some of the listeners out there are kind of thinking about this too. But you know, we've got these two separate systems for implementing our subsistence regulations. You know, there's state subsistence regulations, there's federal subsistence regulations. For the most part, we always try to work together with the state to try to bring the federal regulations similar to what the state has. However, sometimes that just doesn't work out because, our federally qualified users are wanting something different than what they get, than what's provided under state regulations. And so in some cases, we are, you know, either allowing more fish to be taken or longer seasons a species may allow a species to be taken for subsistence when the state doesn't allow that species to be taken. So depending where you're at on the landscape, there may be differences between state and federal regulations for subsistence or sport, for that matter.
So I would take it that is how we establish zones for different fish and what kind of limits are available in different areas.
Right. Well, and that's why, I brought with me today, I'll leave them with you, but you can get these online as well. But we put together our own regulation books for both fish and wildlife use on federal public land. So along with the state booklet on hunting and fishing that a person may pick up, if you're a federally qualified user, you may be picking up our federal books as well.
Always good reading while you're waiting to get one.
Yeah.
If you got the line down in the water, it's good stuff to read while you're waiting.
Yeah, make sure you're legal, for sure. You know, there's a lot of times when, like I said, the state regulations and the federal regulations aren't quite the same, and so the subsistence users from the rural areas, they actually have to choose whether they're going to fish or hunt under state regulations or federal regulations. And they'll choose based on what's most advantageous for their particular location, their particular situation.
If we are running like short of a certain species, who determines what has first priority? Like, say, does the subsistence have priority over sport versus commercial? How does that work?
Well, both under state law and federal law, that subsistence is supposed to be the first priority. I think under the federal regulations, we kind of take it a step further by saying it's a rural subsistence priority. So, you know, on occasion, we have closed certain areas to fishing or hunting to basically ensure that the subsistence priority is met. We don't do that often. We don't do that. We don't take that action lightly or capriciously. It's a very studied, involved process to make a closure like that, and we want to make sure we have all the information before we make a closure to non-federally qualified users. But we have on occasion in the past, and I imagine we will in the future as changes in populations occur naturally.
Right. Does subsistence have priority over sport, and if so, does subsistence have any limits?
Virtually on all our fisheries here in Southeast, subsistence fisheries here in Southeast Alaska, we do have harvest limits, household harvest limits for various species that people may be interested in getting. Other places, there are no limits. Like up north, there are no limits for certain species, certain places, certain times. You can talk about the priority. Now, like I said, both under state and federal law, the priority is subsistence use over sport and commercial and personal use and all that. Same thing under federal regulations. You know, we have marching orders that rurally qualified subsistence users have a priority, are supposed to have a meaningful preference for the use of those fish and wildlife resources on federal public lands. And so we try to provide that through our regulatory process, provide that priority. So, for instance, deer in Unit 2 on Prince of Wales Island, there's a 1 week. The federal season starts 1 week early to allow subsistence users to hunt a week early than the state hunt starts. And also there's a closure for the first week of the state hunt to federally qualified users only on federal public lands on Prince of Wales, on a portion of Prince of Wales Island. You know, so that's how we provide a priority for deer for folks who live in Unit 2, Prince of Wales Island. Another example is here, Unit 4, which is the ABC Islands, Admiralty, Baranof, Chichagof Islands, for deer there. The state system, it's an August 1st through December. I think for the most part, it's August 1st to December 31st, three deer limit. The federal regulations have an August 1 to January 31st hunt. So there's a 1 month in January where federally qualified users can hunt. Plus, we allow 6 deer to be taken, not 3. So the priority there is provided for by a longer hunt, a longer season, and a greater bag limit. So you go across the landscape and you'll find there are certain places where there's a little bit extra time, or there's a little bit extra more deer or fish or what have you to provide for that preference, to provide for that priority.
All right. And commercial versus sport, and resident versus non-resident?
Well, we really don't get into those type of allocation issues. That's something that the state really gets involved with on their side of the system for their jurisdiction. When there's a problem providing for subsistence, federally qualified subsistence users, hopefully, I think we would work with the state ahead of time to make sure we don't get into that situation where there's a shortage. But if there does become a shortage, then we have to react by providing the priority for the rural federally qualified user. And that's pretty narrow, and it's a pretty we don't have to get off and start talking about personal use or commercial or anything like that. It's just providing for that priority for rural users.
All right, and I did ask you before, do we have any invasive species up here? And you identified something that I wasn't expecting. What is it?
Well, we really don't have invasive fish up here. I mean, you know, people hear about the Atlantic salmon being farmed down in Canada, and sometimes they get loose up here, but we haven't really found where they're reproducing here in Alaska. We haven't found that yet. There is an aquatic invasive, though. There still is another aquatic invasive species here, and that's called Elodea, or Elodea, and that's a plant. And you'll find it. They have some pretty severe outbreaks in Anchorage, in some of the lakes in Anchorage and on the Kenai. We have Elodea issues here at Twin Lakes here in Juneau. And basically those plants are basically, they've gotten loose from people's aquariums, basically, and gotten into the waterways. And they kind of bloom and choke out all the other plants. And so I know here in Juneau that the solution for that at Twin Lakes is that they, every time in the wintertime or late winter, early spring, they draw down the lakes. That's why you see those lakes being drawn down in late winter, early spring. And that's basically to kill all the Elodea. And then the lake fills back up again, and then they can stock it for their family fishing days and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah. You know, aquatic invasive is Elodea or Elodea, and it is a problem in some places in Alaska. So there are aquatic invasive species up here.
Cal, where can our listeners find out more information about the subsistence limits and the regulations?
Well, the one of the best places to go is, and I'll just read the website here. It's www.alaska.fishandwildlifeservice.gov. And you can navigate there to the Alaska Subsistence Management page, and there's lots of information on that website. That we have copies of our regulation books and the regulatory cycles, who's on the councils, who's on the board, Federal Subsistence Board, lots of information for folks to look at and get more involved if they choose to.
Right, and that would also be where they could put forth any proposed changes that they'd like to submit.
Right, when the proposal proposal period is for fisheries is in January, and generally the ones for wildlife are around February, March, somewhere in there. Every year it's a little different. Keep an eye on the website for the proposal periods, but. You can, through that site, you can go in and actually put in your proposal on the website, through the website, and get it into the system. We also take them by mail or in person at the council meetings as well, regional advisory council meetings.
All right. Cal Caspit, thank you very much for being our guest on the show today.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
This is Bird Note. David Sibley's paintings connect millions of people with the lives of birds. His delight and skill in observing and portraying birds culminated in the Sibley Guide to Birds, now in its second edition.
I spent years in the field just traveling and birding and sketching. Just doing pencil sketches and getting to know the birds, learning the shapes and the postures and the general patterns. The drawing was so important to me that there was never any question in my mind of continuing on to paint the birds. It's how I study the birds. And then when I go into the studio to paint, I have my sketches. I gather together all the photographs I can find. I've already visited museums and looked at specimens and taken notes on those. But what I try to put into the painting is sort of a synthesis of all of the things that I've seen, all the things that I've learned. It's the impression of many experiences.
You can watch a video of David Sibley sketching a Townsend's warbler at birdnote.org. That's BIRDNOTE, all one word, .org.
The clinic is closed and you or a loved one don't feel well, or you have a health-related question that can't wait. What do you do? Here's the solution. Starting July 1st, Search will have a free after-hours nurse triage line for our patients in Juneau. Search's free after-hours service is available by calling 1-800-613-0560. For life-threatening emergencies, please call 911.
This message brought to you by Search, your partner in health.
And the Juneau Afternoon continues. It's 3:25 p.m. My next guest is Annette Coggins, and she's the owner of Rain Tree Quilting, and she's going to discuss the details about the upcoming kids' sewing classes. Hi, Annette. How are you?
I'm great. I sure appreciate you letting me come and talk about our upcoming camps.
I thought I was going to get Debbie, but I guess we're getting you. That's even better because you're the owner.
That's right.
All right, and tell us about the kids' classes that are coming up.
Okay, well, we have four camps coming up. The first week, next week, July 21st through 23rd, we have our advanced sewing camp, and that's for kids and teens who have already taken camp 1 and 2. And we've had a camp 1 and 2 earlier in the summer, and we've had them previous years, so there's lots of kids out there who've had the camps. Or if you're someone who's been in a school-based sewing program, you've sewn at the middle school maybe, then you'd be welcome to come to the advanced camp as well. And what we're doing in there is allowing students to actually pick what projects they want to work on. So they might want to make a skirt, they might want to make a pant with zippers, or there's all kinds of advanced projects that they can make and have a teacher who will work them through whatever project they want to work on. So that's our first camp, and then we start the series over again with camps 1, 2, and 3, and camp 1 starts out with a very beginning program for kids who have never sewn before, and they learn the basics of how to use a machine, how to read a pattern, how to make a basic, basic projects, and so they're all meant to be skill builders and build on each other. So you take camp 1, then you can go to camp 2, camp 3, and on to advanced sewing.
And are most of your attendees girls, or are there some boys that attend these as well?
Yeah, we have girls and boys. We ask that they be 10 and older, and occasionally if someone's younger than 10 who's been sewing with their mom or dad, they're welcome to come in as well. Usually the instructor talks with them and makes sure that they're ready for that class. It's an all-day class, so we found that by the time they're 10, they have a better attention span to be there for all day, but the kids have a great time. We have quite a few boys as well as girls. During the first camp, the kids make pillows and pillowcases for their room, so they learn how to read a pattern, and they all leave with projects for their room. The second class, they make pajama pants, and so you can have a boy's pattern or a girl's pattern, it doesn't matter, and we get both sexes in there taking classes. We have adult sewing classes as well. These are kids' camps coming up, but we have many men that take our adult sewing classes as well.
Okay, when do the next camps start up?
Camp 1 will be July 28th and through 30th, so it's a three-day camp. And Camp 2 is a two-day camp that follows that on July 31st and August 1st. It's really best to take that whole week. Camp 1 and 2 is a, five-day program together, and they really build on each other so that you get started with sewing, learn the machine, and then the second camp you make pajama pants. Then Camp 3 will be August 4th through 6th. And the kids make footed pajamas, which that's something the kids have requested because all the schools have pajama day and everybody likes to go in with their footed pajamas on. And so the kids can make their own and make them out of whatever cool fabric they want to make them out of. So they have a great time. They are very creative. We have a fabulous teacher who's really good at directing the kids. So if they, if some kids are a little faster than others, then she's got them using their scraps to make other projects as well.
And what has been the interest in these camps in the past? How full are they? I mean, how many kids do you normally have in each one?
We usually limit the camps to 8 students, and most of the time they fill up. So it's important that you get registered as soon as possible. The Vance Camp, this is a new one that we're doing this next week. And so, you know, we're looking for students who've already taken classes who have requested these to come back and take those. So I think that'll be a little smaller class, but camps 1 and 2, typically we have 8 students. Sometimes we'll bump it up to 10. And we provide the sewing machines, so kids don't have to have their own sewing machines. Parents don't have to know anything about sewing. There are some basic supplies that they'll need that we'll give them a list, and they'll need to purchase their fabric for their project. But we do provide the machines for them.
All right, Annette, and how about adult classes?
We have all kinds of adult classes. We have Learn Your Machine classes. We also, we are the Bernina Sewing Machine dealer, so with Bernina Sewing Machines, you get free classes when you purchase a Bernina Sewing Machine. So we have beginning Learn Your Machine classes for Berninas, and then we also, if people have other brands of sewing machine, our first class is called Learn Your Machine. So sometimes somebody's been given a machine or they've purchased a machine, they don't have an idea how to use it. So we have a one evening class on Learn Your Machine, and then we have a basic sewing class for adults. And our adult sewing class is the same thing. They're kind of broken down into modules, so depending on your skills, if you already know how to use your machine, you can come into the next class, which is sewing basics. Then we do pajama pants with adults as well. These are all skill builders that when you're learning about garment construction, when you're doing pants, you learn how to put a elastic waist in, how to hem the bottoms, and then when you make a pajama top, you're starting to learn about sleeves and collars and buttonholes. And so our classes for garments are all broken into modules, and you do a continuation of skills. And then we also have beginning quilting classes for people who are more interested in quilting than garment sewing or craft sewing. And then we also have a lot of classes like different bag classes or craft classes. We really try to have classes for every type of sewer, whether you're a craft sewer, a quilter, or a garment sewer.
And I know that you have other store products and services that you offer. What would they be?
Well, we sell sewing machines. We sell fabric and notions, and we're there to hopefully inspire everyone to sew and to craft. And, you know, we live in a place where it rains a lot. And
don't we know that?
Yeah. We all need hobbies that we can do inside to keep us busy and feel creative. And I was just talking to Jeff Brown out in the hall that, you know, a lot of people just come into our store because they feel the need for a little color therapy. And they come in to see the bright colors on a yucky day and feel inspired. And just doing something creative and making something with your hands does a lot for your mental health in the wintertime and even this time of year when we wish we had a little more sun. So,
oh, far different than this morning looking out the window, though.
Yeah.
All right. And Raintree Quilting, where would we find your store?
We're at 2213 Dunn Street, and Dunn Street is just a little dirt road that's behind the new Paradise Cafe out in the valley, and we're across from AT&T, so we're right off the old Glacier Highway, where Old Glacier Highway and the Loop Road come together. It's kind of confusing to explain it, but just across from Frontier Suites and AT&T behind the new Paradise Cafe. We've got a big sign on our building, so we're there in the valley. We've got a great, beautiful building, big classroom, a shop, and if you can't find us, call us. We're at 789-7900, and we can help you find the place.
Annette, do you have a website where people can get more information about the upcoming classes, or would they just call you?
Either way, our website has all our classes posted, and if you, we have a calendar with all our classes up on it, and if you click on the actual class, it'll give you a description and the level of the class. And so if you go to raintreequilting.com, it'll explain all our classes that are in there. So.
All right, Annette Coggins from Raintree Quilting, thank you very much for being our guest on the show today.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was The Searchers with Needles and Pins. I thought that kind of fit in with Annette and her sewing classes coming up. Anyways, got some public announcements to read off. Juneau Votes information, Southeast Get Out the Native Vote, and Juneau Votes will be registering voters at Marine Park during Oyster Fest from 2 to 8 p.m. this Saturday. It's July 19th. This is one day before voter registration deadline for the August 19th primary election. Evidently, you got to be registered 30 days in advance. And the Island Institute's Sitka Symposium will be held July 20th to 26th in Sitka with guest speakers Winona LaDuke, Louis Alberto Urrea, Alan Weissman, and Molly Sturgis. Full registration spots are still available and individual events are open to the public. For more information, visit islandinstitutealaska.org, that's all one word, or call 907-747-3794, and we'll be right back.
Summertime is the best time to read for fun, so visit the Juneau Public Library and learn about Fizz Boom Read, our summer reading program. Meet authors, play games, win prizes, experiment with science, make crafts, and read books. It's not just for kids, and it's all free. The fun begins May 30th at the Juneau Public Library. Visit juneau.org/library for more information or find us on Facebook. Brought to you by the Friends of the Juneau Public Library.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 15th of July, 2014. Today begins the Hemingway Days Festival in the Florida Keys in Key West, where Hemingway spent much of the 1930s. It was on this day, 2006, that Twitter was launched, only it was called TWTTR Twitter, with no vowels, a social media platform famous for its 140-character microblogs, a social network based on text messaging. It's the birthday of the microbiologist Thomas Francis Jr., born in Gas City, Indiana, 1900, studied medicine at Yale and did research on bacterial pneumonia, but he was particularly interested in the study of viruses. He was the first American to isolate the human influenza virus and develop the first flu vaccine. He also discovered that there was more than one kind of flu virus, which is why epidemiologists release a different flu vaccine every year. Francis's flu vaccine, it is said, has directly saved more than a million lives. One of his first students in his laboratory was Jonas Salk, who went on to develop a vaccine against polio. It's the birthday of Thomas Bulfinch, Newton, Massachusetts, 1796, who studied mythology and legends and who gave us three volumes of mythology and folk tales, which combined in one volume was entitled Bulfinch's Mythology. It was first published in 1881 and has never been out of print. It's the birthday of the novelist Iris Murdoch, born Dublin, 1919, who wrote all of her novels in longhand, wrote them twice, and then put the manuscripts in a plastic bag and delivered them to her publisher and never allowed her books to be edited. Her books include The Sea, The Sea, which won the Booker Prize, and The Good Apprentice. And in the 1990s, she wrote her final novel during her early stages of Alzheimer's, a psychological thriller called Jackson's Dilemma. Iris Murdoch, who said, "Writing is like getting married. One should never commit oneself until one is amazed at one's luck." And it's the anniversary of the commencement address by Ralph Waldo Emerson to the Harvard Divinity School in 1838, entitled The American Scholar, in which he laid out his philosophy of transcendentalism. It made Emerson famous, but it also made many people angry, and so he was not invited back to Harvard for another 30 years. Here's a poem for today by Alexander Pope, Solitude. Happy the man whose wish and care a few paternal acres bound, content to breathe his native air in his own ground, whose herds with milk, whose fields with bread, whose flocks supply him with attire, whose trees in summer yield him shade, in winter fire. Blessed who can unconcernedly find hours, days, and years slide soft away, in health of body, peace of mind, quiet by day. Sound sleep by night, study and ease together mixed, sweet recreation and innocence, which most does please with meditation. Thus let me live, unseen, unknown, thus unlamented let me die, steal from the world, and not a stone tell where I lie. Alexander Pope's poem, Solitude. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
And it's 3:43 p.m. You're listening to KTOO 104.3 in Juneau. A Juneau afternoon continues. My next guest is hot off the streets and into the studio. It's Pat Race, and he's going to talk about the Juneau Underground Motion Picture Society, or JUMPS, Summer Film Fest, which begins July 17th.
That's
welcome
right.
again, Pat. How are you?
I'm doing great. Yeah, it's wonderful out there. It's a beautiful day.
Yeah, probably had to drag you in off the street because the forecast sure isn't right. It says it's supposed to be mostly cloudy. I'd say it's mostly sunny right now.
Yeah, it's mostly all right.
All right. Can you tell us about the Jump Society Summer Film Fest that's coming up?
Yeah, we have shows on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Gold Town Nickelodeon, and admission is free. It's all locally made short films. It's an event we've been doing for a long time here in Juneau. We do it about twice a year, and we get a whole bunch of submissions from local folks, and the only rule we really have is that they have to be 10 minutes or less.
All right, so nothing like Anton Deron's Space Trucker Bruce.
Well, we've had some clips. We've had some clips from his film. We've had some previews over the year.
I know Anton pretty well.
But that was a pretty big epic film. It was great, and I think that's actually a really good example of something that I think grew out of the festival. I think that our festival has been really good at nurturing local filmmakers and a place for them to experiment and learn about their craft. And you know, now we have filmmakers like we have two filmmakers from Juneau who have been featured in the Banff Festival, I think. Is that right? Or which one was that? One of the mountain film festivals that went around. And then we have filmmakers who've submitted to all kinds of festivals outside of Juneau, and giving them a chance to screen their short films here helps them learn what it's like to be in front of an audience, what people react to, what they don't, what's working, what isn't, and what they need to improve on. So it's a good place. It's a good testing ground.
All right, and how many submissions did you get for this round?
I don't know the total number because they tend to trickle in late.
last-minute editing coming off the wire.
Well, that's
here.
What happens. It's technology. You know, we always set our deadline. We have a good, firm, hard deadline like the week before, and then we get usually about five or six people that need to extend that because, like, you know, my dog ate the homework or the computer drive crashed or whatever it is, or they just need to kind of polish things up or whatever it is, and it's nice to have a little bit of buffer time there in case someone runs up against that.
Okay, any idea what we might see coming up?
Yeah, I mean, there's outdoor films, there's comedy, there's music videos. I haven't seen everything, but the ones I have seen are really good. I'm really impressed with the way people have, in the last two or three years, and I'm not sure if it's the technology is getting easier to handle or what it is, but people are really have been upping the quality of films in the last few years.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Be looking to see something really terrific.
Yeah,
and,
it's great. And we get to screen HD at the Gold Town, which is fun too. So it's
all
nice.
Right. And remind everybody when this is coming up.
Yeah, it's Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. We've got two shows on Friday and Saturday, 7 o'clock and 9 o'clock, and the one show on Thursday at 7 o'clock. You can get free tickets at the Alaska Robotic Gallery, or you can show up at the door if you want to chance it. Sometimes the shows do overflow. It's great. It's a lot of fun. Come have a bag of popcorn and watch and see what people in your community are making.
All right, and on a side note, how's your map coming along?
Oh, it's been great. Actually,
we talked about that last week.
I printed 500 copies of the little folded map, and we are out of those. And I have people asking me for more, so I'm printing another batch of them. And we still have the prints available. If someone wants something that's suitable for framing to put on the wall, they can come by the gallery and get those too.
And that's at Juneau Robotics, right?
Yeah, Alaska Robotics. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. And remind everybody where that's located.
Oh, 220 Front Street, right between the Viking and the Gross Alaska Theater.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And the Summer Film Fest is coming up, and this is actually really good.
And we do the film festival twice a year, and so if anyone, if you're inspired to make a film or if you're still working on one and didn't get it done for this one, there's always the next one. There's always the winter festival, and we'd love to see things by new artists. We'd love to see things by old favorites. You know, if you're a musician, find some images to put your music on. There's a lot of different ways to participate.
Right. And Pat, how did Jump start out?
It started out because my friends and I, we've always liked making little short films, and it's really impractical to share a 5-minute film with an audience. You can't really invite someone to come and sit down for 5 minutes and then leave.
Hey, you want to see my film?
Yeah.
You got 5 minutes? There we go.
Yeah, don't quite get time to dig into the popcorn. So we thought it would be better to invite a whole bunch of other people in and show their films as well. And then everyone kind of has a shared audience, and it's a shared experience, and it's a little bit more of a production. And so that's really what it grew out of. We did a similar film festival in college up in Fairbanks. And then when we came down to Juneau, there was a guy out of Anchorage, Bob Curtis Johnson, came through town with a thing called Bob Shorts. And we're like, why aren't we still doing a film festival like we did in college? It would be just great fun. So it exists, and I'm very happy about it. We got a $50 startup donation from the Arts Council.
Was that like a Kickstarter?
No. I went in. It was really funny. I'm just out of college, and I went into the Arts Council board meeting, and I had to like present to them about this whole thing I wanted to, just for this like $50 to print a poster for the event. And they're like, okay, kid, here's your
$50 here.
Nice, go do a film festival.
Yeah, nice speech. Here we go, $50.
Yeah, so that was our seed money, and then it's been totally self-sustaining since then. We get donations from the audience and film goers, and we put in a little bit of our own money, and it's been doing well.
Great. Okay, Pat Race from Juneau Underground Motion Picture Society. One last time, show times on Thursday.
Thursday at 7, Friday at 7 and 9, and Saturday at 7 and 9. And free tickets are available at the Alaska Robotics Gallery, 220 Front Street.
Okay, thanks again, Pat, for being our guest on the show today.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
All right, and now I got time for one short story by Tongass National Forest District Ranger Pete Griffin. This one's going to be called Talks with Wolves. Enjoy.
A friend and I were pulling Dungeness crab pots in a remote bay near Ketchikan, Alaska, on one of those fall days when a cold, rainy drizzle turns into ice pellets. We stacked the pots in the skiff and debated whether or not to make the 20-mile run back home in the sleet with our bucket of crabs or to go ashore and build a fire. As we sat in the skiff discussing the situation, we heard a low moan come from the woods, a moan that rose in volume, continuing for about 10 seconds. Norm and I looked at each other and grinned. We had just heard a wolf howl. They say wolves howl as a means of communicating with other wolves. Nobody has ever interviewed the wolves to ask them why. It seems like howling is a way for packs to call each other to the site of a kill, or a way for wolves to bond together, or a way for one wolf pack to let the others know about territorial boundaries. But I learned that this tendency to howl is useful in another way. As a wildlife biologist, I transferred from the Huron-Manistee National Forest in Michigan to the Chippewa National Forest in northern Minnesota in 1987. There I had responsibilities for wildlife recreation and fire. Unlike Michigan, there were wolves on the Chippewa. There was a pack to the north that expanded its range onto my district each winter in search of food. We would see occasional wolf tracks out in the woods and every once in a while hear about a wolf sighting. Employees would report to me that they'd seen one of my wolves. When our district reorganized how work was going to be accomplished, I suggested that we hire a new full-time wildlife biologist to work with the folks in timber management. I'd found out there was far more work than I could reasonably do well. Because timber cutting had the greatest effect on wildlife habitat, I figured we needed a full-time biologist working directly with the forester on the district. I was willing to give up that role for which I'd been schooled and trained in order for the district to improve its wildlife management program. So we hired Paul, a young man with a Ph.D. in wildlife who had extensive experience outside the agency. After a couple of years, we started getting regular reports of wolf sightings during the summer and more frequent stories about pets disappearing from backyards. We needed to find a way to take stock of the wolf population, so our new biologist, Paul, devised a howling survey to locate wolf packs. It wasn't a one-man job. It was going to take a lot of help. Now, the way he went about this was to take our folks to the International Wolf Center in Ely, Minnesota, to be trained in the art of howling. All of our employees, foresters, recreation managers, timber sale administrators, business managers, and even the district ranger learned how to howl and how to interpret wolf howls they might receive in return. On a late summer evening, small teams of employees fanned out across a district to predetermined locations. Well after dark, we would throw back our heads, cup our hands around our mouths, and cut loose with howls. Not Hollywood movie wolf howls, but a less musical effort, a long, loud monotone. Ooh. Followed by two more howls just like the first, then we would wait for answers. If we heard nothing for several minutes, we would repeat ourselves and wait again. If we heard nothing after the second howl, we would go on to the next stop on our planned route. To tell you the truth, I was a bit skeptical. After my first two stops, there was no response. At the third, my companion and I howled once, twice, and then from the dark woods at the end of the gravel road, only 100 yards away, came an answer. A howl from a wolf, then quickly joined by a second. It was enough to raise the hair on the back of my neck. In the wee hours of the morning, we gathered to compare results. That night, our crews had heard 4 or 5 wolf packs. They were enthused, especially our employees in timber management who had never before been asked to help in the wildlife program. One of them described being on a darkened lakeshore at midnight, in the hot, humid night air, not a breath of wind, surrounded by the steady drone of mosquitoes. On the far side of the lake, from a small community in the Leech Lake Indian Reservation, the beat of the drums from a Chippewa tribe celebration drifted in. The crew howled, and wolves howled back at them. Our folks felt like they'd been sent back in time 200 years to the dawn of the 19th century when voyageurs paddled the waters of Indian country, trapping and trading with the Chippewa people. Howling for wolves was an unforgettable experience for us that night. I learned a couple of things. I had given up being the wildlife biologist, something I loved doing, and turned it over to another person. But Paul had come up with a project that I was unlikely to have initiated. He had drawn all of our employees into the effort, and in doing so, they were no longer the wildlife biologist's wolves, they were our wolves. And it also made me realize that if the Forest Service was going to manage ecosystems, we couldn't parcel out pieces of the forest management program exclusively to any one set of resource specialists. The wolves didn't care whether it was a forester, a wildlife biologist, or an engineer who was hauling at them. Our goal was the understanding that every one of us was responsible for the whole ecosystem and not just one part. We had taken the first big step toward achieving that goal. It's interesting what you can learn from talking to wolves.
That was Pete Griffin with Talking with Wolves, and that's from his CD, The Skunk Whisperer. Pete's a Tongass National Forest Ranger here in Juneau. And in 1999, he began recording short natural history vignettes for radio. And this has kind of morphed into additional projects, and short stories are rather interesting. All right, I got one announcement to read from CECON in Southeast Alaska. They're going to continue working on the Department of Transportation's Riverside Drive resurfacing and sidewalk construction project. There'll be significant closures and detours on Riverside from 6 p.m. to 7 a.m. all this week. Riverside will be closed from Egan to James Boulevard. There will be no access to Riverside via Egan, Vintage Boulevard, Mall Road, or James Boulevard. Please follow the detours that will be in place. I'm beginning to think that the city's logo is that orange barrel or the cone. I haven't seen much else around here for a while. The construction is crazy. All right, in the forecast, rest of today, according to the National Weather Service, and they haven't updated this yet, but it says mostly cloudy. I disagree. It's partly cloudy, which is what they were expecting for tomorrow, with highs in the mid-50s and northwest winds at 10 miles an hour. Tomorrow, partly cloudy, highs around 63 with northwest winds at 10 to 15 miles an hour. And tomorrow night, partly cloudy with lows around 50, northwest winds at 10 miles an hour. Tonight, also have a special showing at the Juno Planetarium of Galaxy Quest, hosted by yours truly. That begins at 6:30, should be over with by about 8:15. It's free to the public, and we do have popcorn, candy, and some bottled water that are available. Those proceeds benefit the Marie Drake Planetarium. And this is KTOO in Juneau, 104.3. We rebroadcast on translators K276 AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269 AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K201 AM in Gustavus, K220 BT in Hoonah, K210 AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable, digital channel 871. You can pick up our sister stations, KRNN, on 872, and KXLL can be found on digital channel 873. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you. It's been great filling in. Scott's down south, I guess, taking a course, so I've been getting Tuesdays a lot so far the last few weeks, and I'll be with you again tomorrow. I'm Ken Fix. I've been your host for the Juno afternoon today, and again, I'll be around tomorrow to harass you and hopefully entertain you with some interesting stories and guests, but stay tuned. All Things Considered is coming right up.
The presidents of both countries, I met with them. Our group met with them. They want their children back.